It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says broadband access could change the economic game for residents of rural Wisconsin.
First, it was announced yesterday that the State Department of Natural Resources would undergo a massive reorganization. The move, according to DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp, is being made in large part to help alleviate the workload of employees and make the organization run more smoothly.
But critics of the plan say that some of the changes being proposed could lead to a lack of oversight on environmental issues throughout the state.
Steve Verberg joins us now. He's a reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, where he focuses on politics and the environment. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks.
Let's start with the big picture. What did Kathy Stepp and others at the DNR say about the need for these changes?
Well, they see the need in a couple of different ways. One of them is that they've been losing full-time staff positions for about 20 years. While the workload has continued to increase, as the frac sand industry has boomed and the dairy business has put new pressures on the regulatory processes, so they're trying to take some stress off from workers for one thing.
And let's look at some of those issues you just mentioned. The agriculture runoff issue, agricultural permitting with some larger livestock farms, that's gotten a lot of attention lately. They're proposing a change in the way that those get permitted. What would change in what Secretary Stepp is describing?
Well, they would do some work on the front end with engineering firms and with agronomists who help prepare, who already help prepare the permits that spell out how much pollution is allowed and the sort of measures that the CAFOs need to take in order to prevent the manure from getting into lakes or streams or into groundwater. Those take the forms of plans and specifications for the actual dairy facilities and also what they call nutrient management plans that spell out how they spread the tens of millions of gallons of manure on fields, hopefully without contaminating wells or streams.
So while currently, as I understand it, as somebody from the DNR would be at the front end, as you said, of that process, now it would be a private contractor, in effect, helping draw up those plans.
Well, in fact, I think a lot of people are looking at it that way, but the fact is that nutrient management plans are already drawn up by consultants who have to be certified by the Department of Agriculture as certified nutrient management planners. Those are already drawn up by consultants who are hired by the CAFOs, and they're reviewed by DNR to make sure that they comply with all the state laws and regulations. And then they're incorporated into the permit, which is the legal document. And the same side on the plans and same on the plan and specification sides for the building of the barns and the storage facilities and manure lagoons and those sorts of things. That's already done by in most cases by engineers who are hired. It's just and then they're reviewed by the DNR to make sure that they're going to work, and it's not going to lead to a bunch of pollution. What the DNR is talking about doing is trying to encourage these consultants who are hired by the CAFOs, trying to encourage them to sort of up their game and to come in with plans that are that don't require a lot of review. Don't require a lot of changes by DNR staff. They want DNR staff to be able to say, look, we've checked out these consultants. They've got the experience. They know how to write the plans. We can give more of a cursory review and then maybe do spot checks and audits once a year. but the idea would be for DNR staff not to have to be so involved in reviewing and making corrections and changes to the plans, and to be able to get out in the field and actually do inspections and compliance work.
It seems like some of the response to this has, from environmental groups in particular, has been concerned that this means less regulation, laxer regulation, but the DNR is saying no, it will still have that effectiveness, and then DNR will have more staff time for the spot checks you just mentioned. Is that kind of the axis of debate on that one?
Yeah, it is. Kathy Stepp, the DNR secretary, and her deputies have been very clear. They say that this is not a lowering of any standards. And the legal standards are going to be the same. Those are based in federal law and in state law and regulations. But the folks who are critical of it are saying, look, the rubber really hits the road in the fact that the DNR does not have enough staff to do the job now. That was documented by the Legislative Audit Bureau in a report that came out in June. One observer said, look, they're trying to rearrange the deck chairs when, in fact, they just need a whole lot more deck chairs. They need a whole lot more staff to do this work.
Talking to Steve Verberg from the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at a new reorganization plan, for the state's Department of Natural Resources. Steve, is there any indication of a request for more funding for more staff at the DNR from Kathy Stepp?
No, there's not. The governor and the legislature cut the department by 90 positions 2 years ago, and Secretary Stepp is in her proposed budget calls for another removal of another 9 positions. But no increase, no.
And Steve, we focused in a little bit on the CAFO, the larger livestock operations. What are some of the other changes that you see as significant in this plan?
Well, they're going to. They're also, this is part of this effort to try to take some of the pressure off workers who are out in the field in state parks and managing wildlife areas. They're going to no longer have state park rangers who are certified as law enforcement officers carrying badges and guns with arrest powers. They say that there's 163 of these folks across the state, or maybe a few more, and they very seldom use those powers. Mostly they are directing campers, directing hikers, maybe doing mechanic work, maybe doing, just a lot of different things, but very seldom arresting anybody. So that would fall to the conservation wardens of the state, of the DNR's Bureau of Law Enforcement. So that'll be a change. There won't be as many armed rangers that you'll see in state parks after this change goes into effect. When there is a need for actual law enforcement, they'll call a conservation warden in, or I suppose a sheriff or somebody else.
And you'd mentioned some positions being cut over the years there. That included some of the scientific research at the DNR. How is that being reorganized, with the goal of more efficiently using the staff they still have?
Yeah. A couple of years ago, as part of the 90 positions that were cut in 2015, the legislature got rid of half of the senior scientists in the DNR's Bureau of Science Services, which is sort of an applied research group that provided scientific guidance to all the programs, the fisheries and the hunting and everything else in the DNR, but they sort of fell into disfavor with the governor's office and the legislature, and they were cut. What remains of that Bureau of Science Services has been redistributed throughout the department in this reorganization.
And Steve, how much of this can the DNR do on their own? How much do they need legislative approval for?
I think that there will there's just a lot of details that aren't known here. They told me that there will be some statutory changes that will need to be made. Those may be in the budget. There may be other statutes. There's a lot of laws that guide and determine what the DNR and other state agencies do, but that's among the many, many details that we don't know yet and haven't come to light.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rob.
That's Steve Verberg, reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He covers politics and environmental issues there. Join us to talk about the sweeping changes coming to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
Jay McCloskey's business isn't headquartered in Wisconsin, but he wants to move it here. McCloskey bought a farm in Crawford County in the hopes of shifting business to Wisconsin, but one big hurdle stands in his way: access to high-speed internet.
As Wisconsin counties struggle to bring broadband to underserved rural areas, Vilas County in northern Wisconsin has worked with Frontier Communications and other internet providers to roll out increased broadband access using federal grant dollars.
In the meantime, Jay McCloskey is fighting to move forward on broadband in rural parts of the state in his area. He joins us now. He's an organizer of the group Universal Broadband Access Coalition. Jay, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, Jay,
thank you very much for having me on and your interest in this issue.
I'm curious about how this group got started, Universal Broadband Access Coalition. Why did you and your neighbors decide to start this group up?
Well, it started with a meeting that we scheduled, we requested with Senator Schilling. Our neighbors on Stony Point Road and our neighbor in our office building we had to get because we did not have high-speed internet on our farm as we had been told we would when we bought it. And that group grew to involve all of our legislative representatives, Senator Baldwin also, and Congressman Ron Kind's office attended, along with people from the University of Wisconsin Extension and the e-commerce group and a number of technical experts, and we talked about how we could go about getting high-speed internet because all of us, three neighbors in a row, all need this for our businesses very much and do not have it. Our speed at our farm is 0.03 megabytes upload and 0.24 download. We were told we'd have 3 megabytes up and 24 down.
Can you tell me a little bit about how that slow internet speed, lack of high-speed internet, affects your business?
Well, our business is not capable of running with speeds at that speed. I don't know if you remember old, many years ago, dial-up. This mm-hmm. is slower than dial-up. You click on a website and watch the screen paint one line at a time. And in our business, I own an insurance agency. We use VoIP phones, voice over internet protocol, and we have remote workers in four different locations. And the insurance industry has become paperless. So without high-speed internet, we can't function at all. And we ended up having to find an office in the Mercantile Center in Gays Mills, which does have high-speed internet. It actually has fiber optic installed to the building. And our speeds there are 30 megabytes upload and 60 megabyte download.
And that's how it affects your business. What about your day-to-day life when you're not trying to conduct business, but maybe you want to do a little online shopping or, you know, listen to music, something like that? What is it like then?
Well, at the farm, often we can't. What we use right now are cell phones for internet, but that's fairly limited. Sometimes I have to walk around with a cell phone over my head and waving it around to try and get a connection. And went to look up a recipe for Thanksgiving and couldn't get internet access. So just not able to. I have a subscription to great courses and, you know, for online education. I can't do it at the farm. Can't watch it at all.
And I've read that, you know, this isn't just about you and your neighbors and your area. This is something that affects the rest of the state. Do you have a sense about how it might be affecting communities in your area in general and maybe kids who need the internet to go to school and do some of their coursework?
Oh, it really has an amazing, immense impact, especially for rural residents. What I found is that high-speed internet really has a significantly greater potential to benefit rural residents than urban and suburban residents. All the urban and suburban folks have ready access to high-speed internet and take it for granted. They have jobs all around that they can go to, they can drive to. They have all kinds of resources for shopping and commerce and being able to do online education is easy because they have that available. In rural communities, there's a problem with jobs. There's a problem with keeping children and retirees in the community who are moving to cities because, in many cases, because they don't have high-speed internet. And in our area, we have the schools and the library have Wi-Fi service that people can tap into, and more schools and children are getting education online and coursework and homework online. And so you can see parents sitting in their cars in the parking lot of the schools and the library at night with their kids, so they're able to do their homework.
And you said earlier you bought this farm in Crawford County, and you were told that you would be able to get broadband access there. What happened? Why don't you have it?
Well, before we bought the farm, we called CenturyLink because it was a priority that we have high-speed internet in any property we purchased. And they came out and tested our lines, and they told us that we would be getting the 3 megabytes upload and 24 megabytes download. And when we had it installed and we tested it, we discovered that, no, we didn't. And at that point, we bought the farm, and I'm happy we did. It's a wonderful farm. But it has significantly changed our plans, and we're not able to have the office on the farm as we had intended. And our neighbors also have children who have had to move out of state and would like to work at the farm and have businesses that use the internet, and they're not able to do that. They have to live where they're able to have high-speed internet.
We're talking with Jay McCloskey right now, organizer of the Universal Broadband Access Coalition. This is a group devoted to bringing broadband internet access to rural Wisconsin, and in particular to Crawford County. Jay McCloskey lives in Crawford County and is the president of Transportation Insurance Professionals. And I want to go back to something you just said. You just said there are children of families in your area who move. Literally, it sounds like they move because they don't have broadband access. So, you know, when we hear about the economies of rural Wisconsin hurting, it sounds like this could be a piece of the puzzle, bringing people back or keeping people there.
It would have a significant impact on that. And in our own business, we have 40% of our employees work remotely. And remote working has become a significant trend in the United States. And we have a very serious issue in the rural economy, in the rural areas, with good-paying jobs. You can get excellent-paying jobs working remotely for all kinds of businesses. They don't even have to be businesses in Wisconsin. And the Organic Valley has a significant number of employees who work remotely from home. They found that to be a very effective model for them. Recently, they had someone who was unable to buy a home that she wanted because they didn't have the high-speed access, and she had to buy a different home. Someone else got a job, I heard, with them, and ended up having to drive 45 minutes each way to work rather than work remotely, which is what Organic Valley and she were hoping that she would be able to do.
So, Jay, what's going on? Why isn't it an easily solved problem? Why can't these lines be put down and people get access who want it? What's standing in the way?
Well, it has partly been funding, although I don't know that that's the whole issue, but the funding's there now. The CAF2 Connect America Fund, funded by the FCC, has provided $570 million to the state of Wisconsin, and in order to be able to put in high-speed internet. And the governor has recently said that internet is a priority, a budget priority for Wisconsin. And just today, the Public Service Commission announced that they are putting in another $46 million in funding for rural internet. And we have three primary goals at the Universal Broadband Access Coalition. We are advocating for fiber optic service for all rural residents. DSL is simply not adequate, especially in the rural areas. We're pushing for fast-tracking the installation of high-speed internet networks, whereas the current plan is to have this installed within the next 5 years. And our third goal is to change the priorities for installation so communities that now have the least internet access get high-speed internet service installed, and those communities that now have the most access get upgraded last. Right now, that's being done in reverse order. In Crawford County, Prairie du Chien, the largest community in Crawford County, will have their internet upgraded by CenturyLink by the end of 2016, whereas the smaller communities, Eastman is getting their upgrade completed in 2020, Seneca in 2021, Wazik in 2018. The priority is reversed. The Prairie du Chien has multiple opportunities and for high-speed access, and the residents there can get it. Yet, for some reason, the money is being spent there first.
And, Jay, as we wrap up, what do you want elected officials to do to help solve this problem?
We really need our state and federal legislators and the governor to put pressure on CenturyLink and the other internet service providers that receive the CF2 funding to get this done quickly, to reprioritize, to get fiber optic service installed. And we're also looking for membership. The purpose of Universal Broadband Access Coalition is to provide a collective voice for rural residents who are frustrated about their inadequate internet service, to provide resources, information, education for them to get involved in advocating for high-speed internet in their communities. And we've already heard from quite a few people, most of whom, quite frankly, are angry, as I have talked with them, about their internet service or their...
And Jay, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate hearing that perspective. That was Jay McCloskey, an organizer of the Universal Broadband Access Coalition, a group devoted to bringing broadband internet access to rural Wisconsin.
Wisconsin's rural counties played a big role in Donald Trump's victory here in the state. 18 rural counties that went for Barack Obama 4 years ago went for Donald Trump this time around. Craig Gilbert of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says Trump's strong turnout in rural Wisconsin made up for a relatively soft performance in Republican strongholds in the Milwaukee suburbs.
That's part of the story behind the differences between polls and election outcomes. But what made those counties go from Obama to Trump? Our next guest has been studying the urban-rural divide in Wisconsin for years now. She goes beyond the polls and actually talks to people in different parts of the state. She says feelings of resentment in rural and small-town Wisconsin helped fuel support for Donald Trump.
Kathy Kramer joins us now. She's director of the Morgridge Center for Public Service and professor of political science at UW-Madison. She's the author of The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker. Kathy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I saw you quoted, I think, in the Washington Post talking about people who had voted for Barack Obama and voted for Donald Trump, and in some cases in rural Wisconsin, they did it for the same reason. They were looking for a change agent.
Yeah, absolutely. So when Barack Obama came on the scene 2008, people thought that maybe this was a different kind of politician. You know, in the years that I've been spending with folks since about that time and until now, a lot of what I hear in our smaller communities is people just feeling like whatever the system is currently is not working for them and really wanting something significantly different, which is what Donald Trump said he would deliver.
And you see a big disconnect between the way people think, talk about politics and talk about each other, in particular when you look at urban Wisconsin and in Madison versus the rural parts of the state. Can you give a brief overview what each side of that divide is saying about the other?
Yeah, sure. Well, in some ways, there's more similarities than not. So in all parts of the state, I heard people saying that they felt like both parties didn't pay attention to people like them, and they were not happy with politics as usual. But what really interested me in the rural parts of the state was the sense that their sense of being overlooked was so tied to their identity as folks from a small community. Their sense that all the attention goes to the cities, the resources go to the cities, and so their sense of kind of injustice or being left out was really tied to their residential location.
Let's talk about each of those things you just mentioned: resources and attention. Let's start with resources. You've tried to track, you know, how much actual money goes that comes in from taxpayers via the state to rural versus urban communities. Is there a big difference?
Well, no, there's not. So this is, you know, I want to be careful about how I say this, because when you look at on a county basis, on a per capita basis, it isn't the case that rural counties in Wisconsin, according to 2010 dollars anyway, were getting less than people living in more urban counties.
Per person.
Right, right. And that's with respect to state and federal tax money. But then when you look at our levels of poverty in the state and unemployment, median household income, our rural counties fare less well on each of those things. So it depends how you ask the question. I mean, are we expecting people to know, you know, look at those graphs and know those relationships? No. I mean, people know when their local economy is hard hit.
And then let's talk about the attention side. And this is something you focus on a lot, and respect, too. There is something there, isn't there, that the media is more and more urban-based, coastal-based on the national level, and maybe these really are overlooked communities.
Yeah. I mean, I can just talk about my experience in the past month briefly.
Yeah, go for it.
So, you know, I, like many people, did not expect my book to be as very relevant to the outcome of the presidential election as it ended up being. And so almost immediately, even on election night, I've just had a stream of contacts from a lot of coastal media, national media, or local media outlets in other places in the country. And I've really been struck by how much, my apologies to people in the coastal media, how the lack of understanding they have of just Wisconsin in general, small town Wisconsin in particular. And it's little things like reminding, you know, having to remind people that I'm on Central Time and not East Coast Time. Mm-hmm. And that's just a real, like, glaring indicator to me of how focused on the East Coast a lot of people in the coastal media are.
Do we replicate that here in Wisconsin with maybe a Madison and Milwaukee on the one hand and the rest of the state and too much attention? Maybe guilty of that here at Wisconsin Public Radio. I don't know. Do you see that similar thing where maybe we're taking a lot of things for granted?
Well, it's hard. I mean, I'm reluctant to say so without doing a really significant content analysis, right?
Is that the feeling out there?
It's definitely the feeling out there. And if you just look at where, you know, where the media markets are, even if we draw circles around where the daily newspapers are, right, there are places in the state that are outside of those areas, right, or especially along the western edge of the state, in which you might be in a metro media market, but actually you're in the Twin Cities media market, right? And you're not getting Wisconsin news, and that news, if you're not even getting Wisconsin state news, certainly the news isn't paying attention to your community.
Talking to Kathy Kramer from UW-Madison, author of The Politics of Resentment, about the urban-rural divide in the United States, in Wisconsin, how it played out in the 2016 elections last month. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in Milwaukee. Jake, hi.
Hi, yeah. The Trump campaign really heavily used a lot on the Walker and Republican campaign in Wisconsin by using division tactics, be it race or business or, you know, unions or anything that you want to use like that to divide rural, disaffected people from urban.
Breaking up there, Jake, but I think we get the gist. This was a tactic, he says, by Republicans, and something you've talked about from Democrats, people on the left saying, in effect, rural white working class voters were hoodwinked, kind of conned into operating against their own interests. Can you talk about what you see?
Well, what I hear is that those divisions are definitely a part of these perceptions, right? I mean, divisions of race and class, sexual orientation, I mean, those things come into these conversations. But to say that people were tricked into voting for Donald, and I'm not sure the caller was saying that, but to make that argument that Trump used tactics that distracted people from their actual mm-hmm. concerns into these divisions isn't accurate. I think the more accurate story from what I've heard is that those divisions are wound into these perceptions of injustice. So when people are talking about all the resources going to the cities, certainly there is race in that perception, but it is many things going on together, people's sense of who's working hard, people's sense that, you know, public employees, urban elites are making decisions not in their interests, all that. It's all a part of the mix. But yeah, was there a drawing attention to divisions in order to for electoral gain? Yes, it's a common, you know, and very effective political strategy.
Let's talk about the idea of a small town or rural way of life. A lot of people embrace that, love it. They maybe grew up with it. Maybe they moved into it. It's a desirable way of life for a lot of people.
For sure.
The economy is changing, and a lot of the things that supported that, the one small town factory or the family farm that is no longer big enough to sustain mm-hmm. A family, or automation driving people out of business at a warehouse or whatever. Is this part of the basic problem here, that people are looking at the way of life that they love and not seeing a way for it to be economically viable in the future?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of our smaller communities are really struggling. What is our future? How are we going to generate jobs here so that we can have the way of life that we want to, right? And have a stable, like, rewarding means of supporting ourselves and our families. It is a real struggle. And then the flip side question to that is, well, then maybe people just need to move to the cities, right? Maybe people need to recognize that we're becoming more urban society and that's where the jobs are. Well, like you say, people love their communities. They identify strongly with them. They've been there for generations in some cases. And that's asking a lot for people to just pick up and go.
And is that part of the lack of attention that people are talking about, lack of respect, that they don't see anybody, maybe in either party, hearing that and trying to do something about it?
Yeah, I think the sense that I get from folks is people may talk at us. I'm talking from the perspective of someone in a small community. Mm-hmm. People may
who
come
you talk
here.
To? You spend a lot. Yeah. This is your research. You are talking to people over coffee.
Right. I mean, yeah, we're just spending time together. And they're giving me the sense that, you know, people may come here, they may pass through, they may say that they're speaking to our concerns, but they're not actually listening. They're not actually just sitting down with us and saying, what do you think? As opposed to coming to us with some plan that they think is going to address, for example, our local economic needs. Like, people are feeling like misunderstood, not paid attention to, just fundamentally not listened to.
We're talking to Kathy Kramer from UW-Madison. She's the author of The Politics of Resentment. We're looking at the rural-urban divide in Wisconsin politics and American politics and how it played out in the elections. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
If you're in a rural or a small town part of the state, do you feel overlooked by the government and the media? Do you feel that there is this gap in understanding that maybe people just don't listen to rural concerns? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about politics and the urban-rural divide in Wisconsin. Political scientist Kathy Kramer is with us in studio. She's from UW-Madison, and she's the author of The Politics of Resentment.
You can join us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you on the rural side of things here in Wisconsin? Do you feel like the media, the government, policymakers aren't paying attention to you, the things that are important to you, what you need in your community? What could bring people together in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers with Mike in Rusk County. Mike, hi.
Hi. You know, I have a unique perspective on this because I split my time between the urban area of Racine and Rusk County, which is in northwestern Wisconsin. I think the biggest thing is the resentment here, I think, comes from the visibility that appears to be given to urban problems over the visibility of the rural problems. So, for example, if you have a Black Lives Matter march or something like that, then, you know, it'll be splashed on the news, both state and national news. It gets a lot of coverage. But when you look at a lot of the problems that the people up here and northwestern Wisconsin have in the more rural areas, you know, they have just as much poverty. Their poverty rates are not that much lower than the inner city. Their, the jobless rates, et cetera, are not that much lower than they are in the urban city. And you don't have the visibility that, say, FDR had when he pushed through his programs. You know, when you had rural electrification, you saw the linemen out on your pole stringing electricity to your farmhouse. We don't have broadband up here in a lot of these rural areas. You promised it all the time, never shows up. It's these kinds of things that have a very visible impact and get promoted by government when they are doing a good thing for the rural folks. If you don't have that, you know, the only thing that's left to them is, you know, the what they see on TV, and their only conclusion that they can come to is, well, they're not helping us anyway, so I'm going to be more concerned about some of these other sidebar issues, such as reproduction rights, or I'm going to be concerned about gun control, because on the other economic matters, I don't see what you're doing for me.
Mike, thanks a lot for sharing that perspective. Kathy?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Thanks for sharing it. And the broadband issue is a really important one, I think. I mean, I hear that a lot when I'm with folks that it would help. I hear a widespread perception that having better, faster download speeds in their community would help with both obtaining access to jobs, getting job training, and with their local schools. And that's just one thing I'm picking out of Mike's comment. But yeah, it's good to hear his perspective.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Rachel in Tomahawk. Rachel, hi.
Good afternoon, and thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, I really feel like from an educator perspective, the needs of the rural schools are not being listened to currently. The narratives right now coming out of our new Secretary of Education and also out of our state are we need to privatize education and bring more charters and bring more choice to our students. And that is just not a reality in our rural areas. We don't have choice. The narrative is not around strengthening public education. It is about dismantling it. And I really don't feel like they're listening to what our kids in the rural areas need.
Rachel, thanks for that call. And I'll throw in on top of that, I mean, rural schools and Wisconsin rural districts facing problems, high transportation costs. People talk about consolidating, but then people worry, well, if you take, I mean, the school might be the place where Rotary holds its pancake breakfast. It's the community gathering point. What happens if you lose that school?
Yeah, people, I mean, my sense, okay, this is not, I'm not spending time in every Wisconsin
sure.
community, but, you know, every community that I have spent time in, schools are really important. And in the smaller communities, you're right, like there, it's the sense of identity for folks. When people have said to me point blank, when our school goes, we're definitely done as a community, you know. And that's a really important concern to hear, that people working in rural school districts or having kids in rural school districts feel like their concerns aren't being paid attention to. I think there's, you know, a lot you can learn from actually asking people, what do you think the fixes are in your school district?
Rachel, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Kathy Kramer about the urban-rural divide in Wisconsin, politics of resentment, rural areas feeling like forgotten parts of Wisconsin, forgotten parts of the country. We'll go next to Grace in New Glarus. Grace, hi.
Hi. One of the things I would like to correct, one perception you have, Ron, that small family farms are not profitable enough to take care of a family. There are actually studies that have come out of several universities, including now the University of Wisconsin, that shows when you try to get one of these bigger and bigger farms, well, let's go to 100 cows, let's go to 250 cows, and so on, those are actually less profitable than keeping the number of cows to a manageable number for a family, for a small dairy. So, you know, there's one bias that small family farms are not profitable. They are. We don't get what we need in terms of emergency services, in terms of road maintenance. Farmland values are very, very high, $10,000 to $20,000 an acre in this area, but the taxes are not commensurate. We have bridges that are going to collapse if they're not fixed. We don't have the money to fix them. With factory farms coming in and they're taking 25 trucks a day, big trucks in and out for feed, for manure, which is getting spread on land and poisoning our water supply and destroying the health of the soil, they don't pay use fees for the roads. They're damaging the roads severely. There are all sorts of things where the rural communities are, I could come up with all sorts of expressions that I shouldn't say on the radio.
Well, Grace, I think we take your point, though. A lot of infrastructure needs, she says, going unmet in a lot of rural Wisconsin, Kathy.
And it's so great to hear that, right? I mean, all the different things she listed off. A lot of these are issues we just don't hear about commonly from most media. So thank you, public radio. No, they didn't pay me to say that. I mean, just it's really helpful to be able to hear what, you know, life in New Glarus, what are the big concerns? And to hear a counter to the myth that a family farm is no longer viable, right? It's good to hear.
Thanks so much for that call, Grace. Kathy, I wanted to bring up, you're an academic. You're researching this stuff. You're talking to people. This is personal for you, too, though. You're from Wisconsin. What do you think when you see this kind of division? Because you could see this as a strength for the state, right? You want to live in a city? We got cities. University town? Got them. Farm? Yeah. Great. Small town? Lakes? Lots of them. Two big ones. This could be a strength, but it's a factor of division in our state.
Yeah. It is personal for me. I mean, I love this place. And, you know, I'm hearing, when I'm doing my field work, I'm hearing criticism about the cities from people that I have, like, grown to really admire and care about, you know? And so it's really unfortunate, and it is not, I was so shocked when I first heard this stuff in 2007, right? It's not the Wisconsin that I know or that I thought that I knew. And I think that's true of many of us. And I think what gives me hope is that I don't find anywhere that it's the Wisconsin people want, right? And people want to live in a state in which people are good to one another.
So we're living in our city bubbles, our rural bubbles, our suburban bubbles, whatever. Are you seeing any sense that somebody wants to convene and bring people together, get them together and talk and find out what we have in common?
Oh my gosh. Yes, all the time. So, you know, some more formal groups. But honestly, the flow of communication I've received, email, Facebook, surface mail, phone calls from people, you know, Wisconsinites, people in other parts of the country, too, just wanting to know how they might have a conversation, how we might fix it, how we might come together. And, you know, I don't have the answers, but I am certainly searching for them like many other people are.
You're hearing people in cities and in rural areas. You've heard about the division. It surprised you. Are you hearing hopeful signs? Are you hearing a desire for people to not have Wisconsin be that way, that divided state?
I am and I'm not, you know. So there are some people who are looking for some really creative solutions using art or just music or conversation or meditation, ways of bringing people together. And at the same time, I am hearing people saying, are you kidding me? You want me to spend more time listening to white folks in rural Wisconsin? That's the solution? And so that's not a hopeful sign to me. I mean, I understand that sentiment where right now for a lot of folks, the last thing they want to do is listen to people from a different political perspective or for people who voted for an opposing political candidate. But yes, at the same time, there are hopeful signs of people willing to try something kind of creative and unusual to try to bring us together.
We'll leave it there for now, but this won't be the end of the conversation, I'm sure, Kathy. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Kathy Kramer. She's director of the Morgridge Center for Public Service, professor of political science at UW-Madison. She's the author of the book, The Politics of Resentment. A lot of people called and didn't have time to get you all on the air, but you can keep sharing your thoughts, your perspectives, and your stories on the Central Time Facebook page. And I'd definitely like to hear stories. Have you tried to reach across political boundaries, geographical boundaries in Wisconsin to try to find things that we have in common, that we can unite around? Again, post your thoughts and your stories on the Central Time Facebook page.
A
It's getting colder and darker. There's been some snow. So yesterday we asked you to share some of your favorite TV shows for winter binge-watching season, which is upon us, and a lot of you called in with suggestions.
And since then, we've heard from a lot of you online as well. Here's a few of your comments on Twitter. Deshaun says, recommends the show Atlanta, says it's pure gold. I've heard about this. It's a drama comedy set in Atlanta, aspiring rappers, I guess, two cousins trying to, and I've heard great things about this show, but I have not seen it yet.
Okay, another one to
Atlanta,
add.
Atlanta, yeah.
Yeah, Atlanta. We're going to be a long
winter. I think
we're
going to have to quit. Can we do a binge-watching sabbatical?
Yeah.
Do they allow that?
I think
that's
management
a thing,
would
right?
have any problem with that. It should be an easy sell. Well, here's another one. Jordan suggests The Wonder Years. This would be sort of a going
throwback.
Back nostalgia, which also in that same sort of ilk reminds me of Northern Exposure, which I think would be perfect to watch.
My parents
in the
have
winter.
Recently binge watched that. That would be a good one. We heard from Patrick, who recommends Vikings. Saw a little bit of that, didn't get into it. Mr. Robot are at the top of his list, too. Mr. Robot, I hear good things about.
And Bridget says, I absolutely love Shameless on Showtime.
And Jerry says, Grimm, modernized Grimm's fairy tales, and The House of Cards. That's been a big, the Kevin Spacey political series. If you're not too politicsed out, The House of Cards could be a good binge watch. Keep sharing your suggestions on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to the Ideas Network.